Iran says the US is the main culprit in violating the 2015 nuclear deal and blames the European signatories for failing to implement their commitments under the accord. Britain's opposition censures, quote, the incapable Prime Minister over his handling of the evacuation from Afghanistan, calling for the sacking of his foreign minister. Also ahead, Israeli warplanes carry out attacks on the west of Khan Yunis in the besieged Gaza Strip. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran's foreign minister has slammed the US and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal for failing to keep their side of the bargain. We discuss this issue in our news review program with our guests. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Iran's foreign minister says the United States is the main culprit in violating the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also blamed the European signatories to the deal for playing an inactive role towards implementing their JCPOA commitments. The top diplomat noted that Tehran welcomes the continuation of nuclear talks to revive the agreement. Amir Abdullahian, however, said such negotiations must guarantee the rights and interests of the Iranian nation. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories have held several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital this year to salvage the nuclear accord in the wake of Washington's unilateral pullout in 2018. Iran wants the US to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner and assure it won't exit the deal again. Joining us to discuss that is Wilma Leon, columnist and political scientist from Washington, D.C., and also Jim Kavanaugh, the founder of The Polemicist from polemicist.net, that is, from New York. Gentlemen, welcome. And Wilma, if I could start with you. Iran's foreign minister says that the United States is the main culprit in violating the 2015 nuclear deal. Is that a narrative that you would agree with?
Well, absolutely. And first, let me say it's an honor and a pleasure to be on with my dear, dear colleague, Jim Kavanaugh. Yes, because I think it's important for people to really understand that the United States, even during the Obama administration, as this agreement was being negotiated, never really wanted to see this entire agreement come to fruition, because the United States never wanted to see Iran be in total control of its own nuclear program, which is so the Obama administration figured out, you know, maybe we'll get 6 years, 8 years down the road, and then they'll renegotiate the terms to extend this thing, because I think the original term was about 10 years. And so they figured that before the agreement actually came to completion, that they would renegotiate the terms and just extend it. So really what President Biden has done is just advance the interests of and the direction of the Obama administration a few years earlier than originally anticipated. But this is a foolish, foolish, foolish move. The United States needs to just sign on the napkin, get back into this deal, and let's move on with life. Unfortunately, the interests of Israel and their impact on American policy is not going to allow that to happen.
Right. Jim, welcome. Do you see Iranian officials say that, you know, there's no difference between Trump's approach to the nuclear deal and Biden's approach? The only difference is the tone of the language that they use. Do you agree with that? And is that fair?
Well, Biden can easily demonstrate that it's otherwise if he wants to. I mean, it was the Trump administration who was pulled out of this deal. No, nobody needed them to or asked them to. Nothing that the Iranians did made them do it. Biden could, despite the excellent analysis of Wilmer about what the Obama administration was actually up to, they made the deal. And Biden was all proud of the deal. And Biden was, oh, Trump's crazy for dropping this deal. And Biden could be saying right now, oh, Barack and I made this deal. I'm going to get back in it. Look, it's very simple. This is not complicated. The United States left the deal and imposed new sanctions on Iran. The way to fix this is for the United States to go back to the deal as it was. The problem here is nobody really is afraid of Iran's nuclear weapons. What they want to do is to get Iran to agree to limit its missiles and its support of resistance groups throughout the region. Israel is afraid of Iranian missile technology. They're afraid of the Iranian military getting too strong, and they're afraid of Iran sharing that technology with resistance groups throughout the region and helping resistance groups throughout the region organize and fight, which is what Soleimani did, Qasem Soleimani, why he was killed. So really what the Americans want to do here, under pressure from the Israelis, is to get Iran to agree to other things. This is the famous nuclear deal, JCPOA 2.0, JCPOA Plus, whatever they call it. They don't want to go back to the deal as it was, which did a very good job of curbing any imaginary nuclear weapons dreams that Iran had. So they're not, if they were interested in nuclear weapons, they'd go back to the deal. This is about getting Israel is,
right.
as Wilma said, imposing a lot of pressure on the United States to get more aggressive with Iran. And in the current context, after what happened in Afghanistan, I fear that there's a likelihood that the Biden administration will react more aggressively in situations like this.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for that. Interesting points raised. Let's thank our guests, Wilma Leon, columnist and political scientist, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Jim Kavanaugh, the founder at thepolemicist.com, joining us from New York. And that wraps up another edition of the News Review. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has expressed his condolences over the demise of Sheikh Abdul Amir Babilan, the head of Lebanon's Supreme Islamic Shia Council. Ayatollah Khamenei, in his letter to the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said Sheikh Babilan was a valuable and loyal friend of the resistance movement. The Iran leader noted that Sheikh Babilan spent his life in the service of the Lebanese people. Ayatollah Khamenei called the death of the prominent religious figure unfortunate and a great loss. Britain's opposition has slammed Prime Minister Boris Johnson over the handling of the evacuation from Afghanistan and have called for the sacking of his Foreign Minister Dominic Raab.
Mr. Speaker, normally we have a cabinet minister sent to the House to cover for the Prime Minister. But today we have before us the Prime Minister desperately trying to cover for a foreign secretary who should have been sacked weeks ago.
We have a Prime Minister incapable of international leadership just when we needed it most. I know it's uncomfortable. The terrible attacks from ISIS-K highlight the new security threat. The government must act quickly to coordinate international partners to ensure the Afghan government's collapse does not lead to a vacuum for terrorists to fill.
Starmer said the government's actions were complacent and wrong. He said many Afghans, whom he described as eligible for help, were not able to get out. Johnson said 311 people eligible to come to Britain are still in Afghanistan. British lawmakers also lambasted the government for intelligence and leadership failures over the fall of Kabul to the Taliban. The World Health Organization has warned that hundreds of healthcare facilities in Afghanistan risk closure due to a lack of donations required to run them.
Like, that project is the backbone of the health system in Afghanistan. So, I mean, we understand the constraints that the donors work under. They are looking urgently at options, you know, to keep those health facilities open, but we are going to have a pause in operation in a large proportion of those. Probably, you know, by some estimates, up to 90% will cease functioning probably later in the week.
Brennan says the medical facility's risk of imminent closure is because donors are not allowed to deal with the new Taliban government. The official noted that the WHO expects a rolling back of health benefits of the past 20 years if those closures are sustained. The WHO project is comprised of 2,300 health facilities in Afghanistan. Other UN agencies have already warned of a looming humanitarian catastrophe due to drought and displacement. UN agencies have also convened an international aid conference on September 13th. The Taliban blamed the U.S. forces for destroying military hardware in Kabul International Airport before their abrupt withdrawal from Afghanistan. The group said the hardware served as Afghan national assets, which should have been preserved for the Afghan people. Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
Kabul International Airport, which almost 1 week after the departure of the last batch of U.S. forces from the country, is not yet ready to resume its international flights. U.S. forces have intentionally left behind some military and non-military equipment in different parts of Kabul International Airport, a move that took the Taliban some extra time to make the airport operational for domestic flights.
Now we are inside a vehicle of the special unit of Taliban known as Badri 313 Special Forces, and we are going to get to the military part of Kabul International Airport.
American Chinook helicopters are seen in the military section of the airport. The U.S. forces have destroyed the military hardware as much as they could. They have done this to dozens of military vehicles. However, Taliban officials say they plan to fix and use all military hardware as much as possible.
The defeat of the U.S. was a great victory to us. We don't care about damaged military hardware because we will either fix and use them or keep them as a lesson to any other invader.
Furthermore, top Taliban officials described the destruction of military hardware by U.S. forces as their last move toward destroying the national assets of Afghans.
The Americans haven't left any usable military hardware in the airport in order to limit our capabilities, but our nation will go ahead and rebuild their country's infrastructures again.
Despite the fact that the U.S. has damaged the airport, the Taliban say they have already managed to attract foreign investments, mainly from some regional countries, including Qatar and Turkey, to rebuild the hardware to make the airport operational once again. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Israeli warplanes have targeted a position belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas west of the city of Khan Yunis in the besieged Gaza Strip. Our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon joined us earlier with more on the latest Israeli attack.
Israeli fighter jets attacked the security post that belongs to Hamas's military wing, the Izzin Qassam Brigades, west of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, close to the Mediterranean. That the first airstrike caused huge damage to that security post, and about 10 minutes after the first airstrike, two more airstrikes hit that same location. The Israeli regime claims that it was targeting infrastructure of the resistance movement, and also Israeli media said that the airstrikes were in retaliation for incendiary balloons that were launched earlier from the Gaza Strip towards the Israeli regime. But I personally believe that what happened tonight is just a reaction by the Israeli regime to, in other words, the frustration of the Israeli regime for what happened around dawn today when six Palestinian freedom fighters managed to escape from the Gilboa prison and occupied northern Palestine.
And supporters of the Islamic Jihad movement have hit the streets in the southern Gaza Strip to celebrate the escape of six Palestinians from one of Israel's highest security prisons. The rallyers chanted slogans against the Israeli regime, warning it against any attempt to harm the escapees. In the meantime, the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, issued a congratulatory statement. It described the prison break as a grave failure for Israeli guards and a development that has proven the vitality of Palestinian struggle to liberate their land. Israeli forces have launched a manhunt for the inmates. The regime plans to move 400 inmates to other prisons to avoid similar jailbreak attempts. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
Millions of Americans will suffer as they lose critical source of income, and the loss of spending will suppress job growth, says Jake Johnson, journalist, in an article titled Catastrophe Feared as 35 Million Americans Are Set to Lose Jobless Aid. Stay tuned for more. Millions of American jobless workers are set to lose critical unemployment benefits, and neither Congress nor the Biden administration seem prepared to do anything about it. Despite the ongoing threat posed by the highly transmissible Delta variant, the White House and Democratic lawmakers have provided no indication that they plan to prevent several pandemic-related unemployment programs. The consequences of government inaction in the face of what one analyst recently described as the largest cutoff of unemployment benefits in history could be massive, both for those directly impacted by the cuts and a still ailing U.S. economy. As Matt Bruning of the People's Policy Project noted recently, the Labor Department's latest weekly unemployment insurance UI report shows that 9.2 million people are currently receiving benefits from either the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation or PEUC program or the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance PUA program, which were implemented last year to extend the duration of jobless aid and provide assistance to those who are typically ineligible for UI, such as gig workers. According to the Census Household Pulse Survey, the average household that is receiving UI benefits has 3.8 members in it, Bruning observed. This means that around 35 million people, that is about 10% of the U.S. population, live in households that are scheduled to lose unemployment income very soon. He continued, these are not small cuts either. Based on what happened in the states that already cut these benefits, we know that around half of those on UI will see their benefits drop to $0, while the remaining half will see their benefits cut by $300 per week, which is equivalent to $15,200 per year. Those formerly on UI will also cut their spending by about $145 per week, that is $7,540 annually, which will have negative effects on the revenue and employment of the businesses they patronize. But even amid such dire warnings, the possibility of a UI extension has been virtually absent from discussions on Capitol Hill as Democratic lawmakers work to assemble a $3.5 trillion spending package aimed at achieving a range of long-standing policy goals, from major climate investments to Medicare expansion. The Biden administration has not made it a priority, and outside of Ron Wyden, you haven't heard too many people in the Senate be willing to push on it. Andrew Stanter, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, told Vox, referring to the Democratic senator from Oregon, a key architect of the soon-to-expire UI programs, it doesn't seem like right now there would even be 50 votes in the Senate for an extension, Stanter observed. Recently, Labor Secretary Marty Walsh and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said that President Joe Biden believes it is appropriate for the $300 per week federal UI boost to expire. 26 states, each led by a Republican governor except Louisiana, have already ended the emergency UI aid, and the Biden administration did not try to stop them. Subsequent research has vindicated economists who warned that, contrary to the claims and predictions of Republican leaders, ending the benefits prematurely would do little to boost hiring. A Wall Street Journal analysis released recently found that the states that ended enhanced federal unemployment benefits early have so far seen about the same job growth as the states that continued offering the pandemic-related extra aid. While Republicans have insisted that the emergency UI programs are dissuading people from returning to the workforce, analysts have pointed to the myriad other factors at play, including lack of childcare and pandemic-related health concerns. Dr. Rakin Mahmood, the chief economist at the Groundwork Collaborative, warned in a statement earlier this week that amid increasing uncertainty in the trajectory of the pandemic, unemployment cliff could not come at a worse time. Millions of Americans will suffer as they lose this critical source of income, and the loss of spending will suppress job growth, setting Americans back yet again in efforts for an inclusive and equitable recovery, Mahmood said. Painful enough in itself, the benefit cutoff will come just days after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Biden administration's nationwide eviction moratorium, putting millions of people at imminent risk of losing their homes amid a deadly pandemic. The U.S. is currently averaging around 164,000 new coronavirus infections and 1,500 deaths per day. It's going to be a perfect storm for a lot of folks. Jordan Deber, a staff attorney for the New York-based community organization Bronx Works, said of the confluence of UI expirations and the end of eviction moratorium, "We are still in the middle of a pandemic." In a series of tweets recently, Center of the Century Foundation warned that this cliff dwarfs anything we have seen before. If the federal programs expire, jobless workers will be left with often paltry state-level UI benefits or, if they have exhausted their eligibility for such assistance, nothing at all. The unwillingness to extend emergency benefits or even debate it shows how inured we have become to plight of the unemployed, Stettner wrote, adding, with eviction protections ending at the same time, long-term unemployed workers are now vulnerable to lasting economic damage. Black and Latino workers have the least in savings built up to navigate this transitional period. The Congress should have the courage to reinstate benefits, especially in high unemployment states, if the Delta surge slows the recovery. Stettner added, and make permanent changes to UI benefits so that we won't have to rely on emergency programs during the next economic crisis, unquote.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio. I'm Atal, the host of this program. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadiq. Sheikh Sadiq, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum, very happy to be with you.
You're welcome, brother. And Sheikh Qasim, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, regarding the speeches and the addresses of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei, regarding human being, we get into the concept of adala. You know, justice or adala is a concept that the religion of Islam in general and the Muslim rulers in specific are mainly concerned with. So, Sheikh Sadr, let's get to you. What are the grounds how this type of justice, I mean divine justice, that we are looking for can be achieved? I mean, what grounds should be established in order to achieve this adalah? For example, we're going to prepare a ground for ourselves, or from the type of, from the side of the rulers of a society of the Muslim lands. What should they do?
As I said, you know, there's no way except the hujjah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because adalah is only achieved through a balance of all the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
And the only manifestation, complete manifestation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is His hujjah. So right now we can just refer to their ahadith, we can refer to Quran, but it's again through our limited lenses. All of our limitations, all of our experiences, where we're born, our culture, all of this colors what we read in the Quran and in the hadith and everything else. Our place in history, all of this affects that. So we can refer to hadith. That's better than just, you know, thinking without any prerequisite.
Okay.
But it's not going to happen without our imam. And when we understand this, that's when we pray for Zuhur of Imam Zaman, like really seriously.
So the outmost example of adalah is, you know, will be fulfilled with the the manifestation of the, you know,
reappearance of Imam Zaman.
Yeah,
Imam
the manifestation of the Allah's attributes, which is the Hujjah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
But until then, what is, you know?
Yes, this is the question.
Yeah, so
until then, what should we do? Of course, we know that, since the reappearance, inshallah, the Imam is Hayy, the Imam is alive, okay? He's present among us. He's, as they symbolize it, you know, it's the sun behind the cloud, okay? Mm-hmm. His lights and his shining and his rahmah is overshadowing over us. You know, these are like an umbrella covering all the worlds. But the case is that till that time, if we want to have a kind of justice system like that one, or at least something, keep closer, or a picture like that.
The best
what
we can,
do? Yes.
Right? The best we can is referring to hadith. Imam Zaman said, at the beginning of Ghibat Kubra, he said, "Farjou ila ruwata hadithana." So we refer to hadith, we refer to fuqaha, we refer to mujtahideen, we refer to wali faqih, whoever is in charge of the community of mu'mineen at the time.
Okay.
But that's the best we can do. But we have to keep in mind that this is the limited version.
Mm-hmm.
This is not
the original
complete substitute.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that answer is a good one. When we think about, you know, some question or some challenges, some objections that we may have about the, the way that the Islamic Republic of Iran is now carrying out the justice, because we normally get this a lot that,
yes,
you know, if that is the plan, then what is this, you know?
Yes.
So how can we sort of reconcile between that example,
yes,
of, for example, Imam Zaman alayhi salatu wassalam, and the system, the justice system that we've been brought about by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam in the ahadith, and the application that we have been experiencing in the Islamic Republic of Iran? And I think that would be a good
which
answer.
Which is not ideal yet.
Yes, yeah.
You know,
so
fully achieved, which is not fully achieved.
Yeah,
yet,
so we are trying our best, you know, to get there. But of course, there are many things, you know, many hindrances. Let
yes.
alone, you know, the, you know, the.
What are those? What are those obstacles, brother, on the way?
Yeah, I believe the most important ones, and as Ayatollah Khamenei, Hafizullah, he himself describes and actually explains. He says that, you know, we have always in front of the justice seekers, we have always the mustakbirin.
Okay.
So there are some people who are trying their best not to allow people and, you know, sort of expand their own reign of, you know, access.
That's right.
Which consequently leads to what? To the, you know, to the narrowness of the scope of other people's freedom. So, you know, they are always active, the mustakbirin, the ones that try to get
that's
as
right.
more as possible.
Okay.
So this is one of them. So now in the world, you know, there is no need to say that you know, what ideology, I want to really like, yes. to call it an ideology. It's okay. Not just a political
ideology
movement.
In terms
this
of
this is an
yes,
ideology. Okay. That ideology encompasses the Zionism, the way that okay. the United States of America is yes. lead and is governed, and all other people who have this in common with these sorts of ideologies, by making others withdraw from their okay. scopes of freedom,
that's
and
right.
then going on and taking their place.
Sorry, and the sad news is that the Muslim lands are day by day very much becoming similar to the liberal capital system, and this is really the sad news. I mean, if you look at the picture just superficially, it is very beautiful, okay? Beautiful buildings, beautiful houses, luxurious lifestyle, but behind the scene, the rich is becoming richer, the poor is becoming poorer, okay? And this is not the justice or adalah that Islam has been looking for, at least what we know from the side of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the other infallible imams. This is very much like the aristocrat system of justice, whose Baitul Mal has been changed into a kind of khazana, a treasury fund, and then distributed by the ruler of the king among the people according to their own understanding and their own wishes, and which culminated into many tragedies during the history. But the case is that reaching this type of adala from one side is very much easy because we have it inside our fetra, Sheikh Sadeh. From the other side, we have these obstacles on our way. How to manage? Beside referring to ahadith and the verses of the Holy Quran.
That's basically why religion is there.
Okay.
Because the source of all problems is حب الدنيا.
Okay.
Different levels of حب الدنيا. حب الدنيا رأس كل خطيئة. Right? So, in one lecture I had in this Muharram, I said we have three types of religious people. The first type, the lowest type, are not really religious. They're munafiqeen, basically. They just use the name of the religion to get to the dunya that they want.
Their own goals.
They're using the clothing of religion. They're using the appearance of a Muslim, of a mu'min, to get to religion. And we have these throughout the history. They're just using religion to get to money, power, wealth, everything else. And then the second type are the common people, the normal mu'mineen. They are Muslim, but they're not super deep into the root of religion. So they don't understand what they're doing.
Okay.
And so the first type, we can see that they are deep into حب الدنيا.
Yes.
The second type, they just want a peaceful life.
Okay.
They love dunya, but not at the expense of akhirah.
Okay.
But because of their ignorance, because they don't have a correct understanding of religion, they always help the munafiqin.
Okay.
Like never once in history have they helped the third type, the true mu'mineen,
yes.
Amirul mu'mineen.
Okay.
We can see the munafiqin of the time of the Prophet, how they manipulate the common people,
yes.
the majority of people,
yes.
and take them away from Amirul mu'mineen. And Sayyidah Zahra, salamullahi alayhi, in Khutbah Fadakiyah, she says, if you had followed Ali alayhi salam, he would just guide you to the true path, to the truth, slowly, without any pain, without any problems.
That's right.
But the first type, the munafiqeen, scare people away from true mu'mineen. Say, no, they are too serious.
Okay.
They're going to take away your dunya. And basically manipulate them because of their ignorance. So
I'm making you play in the same ground. I mean, when I was looking at this Black Lives Matter, after George Floyd was killed by that police officer in the U.S., most of the models and the slogans that you say in the type of adala they are looking for is playing in the same field of liberal capitalism. Again, they are looking for a type of justice that is done in the social boundaries they are living in, very much leading into a kind of bodily, physical joys, not more than that, okay? But this type of spiritual look at the top of divinity. But the third group that you talked about, the true faithful Muslims, are not many, brother.
Yeah.
The true helpers of Imam Asr, okay? Who
you have to know their forces and their vision. Their
okay.
vision is educating people, bringing
uh-huh.
people up.
Okay.
The soul thing, they think about.
Even justice or adala can be taught, you mean?
Yeah, of course. Like,
okay.
Because we're ignorant of the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because we're ignorant of the place of everything, the appropriate place for everything.
Yes.
You said that if everything is in its place.
In its place, that's right.
That's justice, right?
Okay.
We don't know the place.
Yeah.
We think this is the place,
okay,
right? So our efforts go the wrong way. And if someone comes and educates us about the right way, about the balance of the world, then we can find it in our heart, because that's fitra, right?
Yeah, how much do we know the places? How much do we know the places, brother?
Unfortunately, you know,
knowing
age,
the place is important, okay? We do not know that. We know how to fill our fridge, okay? With different types of fruits, flesh, chicken, flesh, or something like that. But what about the places of different things in our life, okay?
First of all, we have to know, we have to come to this awareness that many of the places that we are recognizing that the places of those things are not right.
Oh.
This is very important. And the reason is that unfortunately this era that we're living in is the era of media. So whatever they want to feed you with the misinformation about the places of things, and this is exactly what you mentioned, that, you know, based on liberalism, you have, you know, some special and some very narrow-minded, you know, places being designated to things.
Yes.
So when we're talking about the justice of, I don't know, human beings, they you know, right away their mind goes to, you know, the equality of women and men.
Yes.
Or, I don't know.
Or
the
payments.
Of, yeah.
The payments or wages.
Yeah. So,
okay.
But this is not the way that... if you go beyond what we've been taught by the media, by the dominant media, that unfortunately the ones that are governing the media, they own the media, are exactly the ones that are trying to strip the justice from its reality and
that's
from
right.
essence, the real true essence of it. So first thing is that we have to become so suspicious about the media. And, you know, as my brother said, one of the ways of education is not just by words. So those, you know, people of God, elect people, we can, you know, they are the examples, the life models of human beings. So by following them, even though that we may not in all details know what they do or what is the reason that they're doing that action. But by following their model and their footsteps, I think that would be a very good step for
some
knowing
people
the places
doubt, some people
of
might things. Doubt this, that the media is a new phenomena, you know, in the last century, but the satanic temptations have always existed during the history. I mean, the type of medium was working out at the time of and its proper place. But the case is that, as you said, we have to refer to our very fitra.
Yeah.
This is, but I think the people in the world and all this justice judicial system are very much concerned with the nature rather than the fitra. And this is the make differentiation. I mean by nature is the physical boundaries and the physical capacities that exist all around us. But if we kind of refer to our very soul and the fitra, then we can find, I think, the true meaning of justice. And then our look at the world will be very much different.
Yeah.
Maybe the places that we consider for the things around might be changed a lot. Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasem and Sheikh Sadiq, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. We tried to discuss justice, adala, and seeking justice based on the viewpoints of the supreme leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Qasem.
Pleasure.
And Sheikh
Sadiq.
Thank you very much. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. For more information, visit our website, apostolate.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Woman. should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst to stay deep inside I know amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense know that you exist guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong in the world that often lies. As I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you know I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
On numerous occasions, the press reported on Canadian troops killing Afghan civilians. Canadian soldiers have repeatedly killed and wounded civilians while on patrol in civilian areas, noted the New York Times in May 2007. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Yves Engler Ryder. This article is published under the heading Canada's Disaster in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. What a waste of human life and resources. More than 200,000 Afghan civilians and combatants have been killed since the U.S., Canadian, and British invasion 2 decades ago. A few thousand Canadian, U.S., British, etc. troops also died in the fighting. Canada's biggest military deployment since the Second World War, more than 40,000 Canadian troops fought in Afghanistan between 2001 and 2014. Canada spent $20 billion on the military operations and related aid mission in Afghanistan. While the stated rationale of the war was to neutralize al-Qaeda members and topple the Taliban regime, the Taliban has now regained control of the country. In October 2001, the United States unilaterally invaded Afghanistan, launching air strikes. Canada's JTF-2 Special Forces aided these efforts. Individuals responsible for massive human rights violations during Afghanistan's mid-1990s war were appointed to prominent government positions. Some in the Canadian Forces CF sympathized with the Afghan warlords. In March 2006, Maclean's reported on General Rick Hillier's enormous respect for the warlords, even making allowances for those who profit from the puppy business. At the peak, over 3,000 Canadians fought a violent counterinsurgency in Kandahar. Between April 2006 and December 2007, Canadian troops fired an astounding 4.7 million bullets, including over 1,650 tank shells and 12,000 artillery rounds. In a line in the sand, Canadians at war in Kandahar, Captain Ray Wiss praised Canadian troops as the best at killing people. "We are killing a lot more of them than they are of us, and we have been extraordinarily successful recently. For the past week, we have managed to kill between 10 and 20 Taliban every day," unquote. In September 2006, the CF spearheaded NATO's Operation Medusa, aimed at Taliban strongholds in Panjabi and Zahari districts of Kandahar. This is how Corporal Ryan Pagnacco described the airstrikes. "After watching bomb after bomb drop on these targets, I wondered how anything could survive. I figured that when we went in, we would be walking into a ghost town," unquote. The Medusa offensive forced 80,000 civilians to flee their homes, resulted in hundreds of enemy combatant deaths, and at least 50 civilians were killed over several weeks of bombing. On numerous occasions, the press reported on Canadian troops killing Afghan civilians. Canadian soldiers have repeatedly killed and wounded civilians while on patrol in civilian areas, noted the New York Times in May 2007. In July 2008, Canadian soldiers killed a 5-year-old girl and her 2-year-old brother after the vehicle got too close to a convoy. Canadian armored vehicles regularly fired warning shots at bikes, cars, or trucks that got too close, often causing crashes, leaving Afghans injured or worse. In June 2006, France 2 TV showed unedited images of Canadian troops searching villages and houses, breaking down doors, and interrogating residents. According to a report in La Presse, Canadian troops were shown telling villagers that it was not smart to join the Taliban because our troops are really good. They are well-trained and good shots, and you will die. Later, the video shows a Canadian commander saying, "Too bad for you if you don't want to tell us where the Taliban are hiding. We will come and kill them. We will drop many bombs and fire all over. Is this what you want? Well then, continue telling us nothing," unquote. Canadian troops' actions in Afghanistan belie claims of high-minded motives. The CF used white phosphorus as a weapon against enemy-occupied lands in Afghanistan, while Canadian Special Forces participated in highly unpopular nighttime assassination raids. The most deadly element of the war was airstrikes. While no Canadian planes dropped bombs in Afghanistan, Canadian troops regularly called in U.S. airstrikes. Canadian personnel also operated NORAD systems that supported U.S. bombings, and some heavily armed Canadian helicopters launched nighttime operations. most of the individuals detained by Canadians and turned over to the Afghan army and prison system were likely tortured. Under the Geneva Conventions, the military force that detains someone is responsible for their treatment, and many of those detained by the CF were likely tortured with knives, power cables, and open flames. The second highest ranked member of Canada's diplomatic service in Afghanistan from 2006 to 2007, Richard Colvin, reported to a parliamentary committee that the likelihood is that all the Afghans we handed over were tortured. Additionally, dozens of individuals given to the Afghan army by the CF were unaccounted for, perhaps lost in a prison system that did not keep good records or maybe killed. Many of those detained by the CF had little to do with the Taliban. According to Colvin, it was the NDS, or Afghan National Directorate of Security, that told us that many or most of our detainees were unconnected to the insurgency. We detained and handed over for severe torture a lot of innocent people, unquote. The CF regularly handed over children they suspected of Taliban ties to the NDS, which often tortured them. The Toronto Star reported that in late 2006, a Canadian soldier heard an Afghan soldier raping a young boy and later saw the boy's lower intestines falling out of his body. Reportedly, the Canadian military police were told by their commanders not to interfere when Afghan troops and police sexually abused children. Despite attempts to portray the situation otherwise, the invasion of Afghanistan did not have UN approval. After the United States invaded, the Security Council was pressured to authorize the use of force to defend the installed Afghan government. Non-American foreign troops in Afghanistan were effectively under U.S. command. Canada followed the United States into this 20-year-long predictable disaster. Every thoughtful person should learn a few lessons. Interference in other countries' internal affairs, whether civil war, as in the case of Afghanistan, or elections, is wrong. War is not good for those who profit from it. Do not trust those who beat the drums for war. They are likely paid directly or indirectly by the military-industrial complex.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.